The tech space is seeing a great revolution, with women rising fast in this space. Although it has historically been a male-dominated field, the narrative is changing and more opportunities are being made available for women to excel and thrive in this space. In today's episode, we are honored to have Ibia Kwao, a trailblazing figure in the industry, as our guest. We unravel the fascinating chapters of Ibia's journey, from overcoming challenges as a woman in tech to becoming a startup founder, failing and returning to the tech space as a UX/UI designer, after what she calls a tech heartbreak. Enjoy today's episode.
This episode is brought to you by BigSpark. BigSpark is the UK's fastest growing data solutions consultancy, translating your business needs into data architecture, strategy, and engineering. Together with their technical partners, they focus on swift and efficient business value delivery. Taking an innovative approach to every challenge, BigSpark is an agile team of over 100 world-class engineers and data scientists pushing the boundaries of what can be achieved with AI, data, software, cloud, and machine learning. To find out how BigSpark can ignite your data solution, visit us at www.bigspark.dev. BigSpark, igniting change through engineering. Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the TechSurf podcast, where we navigate today's tech wave one electrifying conversation at a time. I am your host, Raymond Cluche, and today I have a longtime friend, sister, buddy. I worry her a lot on the daily. But today we have here on the TechSurf podcast, Ibia Kwao. I hope I got the name right, because I've never really mentioned your surname, but we have Ibia here to, you know, discuss her transition, or will I say how she just entered tech and is now, you know, doing amazing things in the tech space in so many areas, which we will delve into in further, or we'll delve into more as we go on in the conversation. So welcome to the TechSurf podcast, Ibia, and we're very grateful to have you here.
Thank you, Ray. I'm excited to be here as well.
Perfect. Okay, so in the shortest amount of time, if you can, you know, describe yourself, a bit of your background, you know, say something short, and then we can get into today's episode or into the details of today's episode.
Okay, so I'm Ibia Kwao, like you rightfully introduced me. I'm a UX designer. I currently work with WeWire Africa, which is a fintech company that's into cross-border payments and transfers as well. I enjoy working on fun products. I freelance as well in my free time. I do a bit of community service. And also, I'm interested in people with special needs. So I volunteer with another organization. It's an NGO that focuses on people with special needs. Yeah,
basically. Right. So Ibia and I were in, I think we're all in the same hostel, or I don't know what, depending on where you are in the world, you can call it an apartment or student apartment, whichever it is. But we were in the same hostel, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And we were friends. We happened to go to church together from time to time. And I never really bothered to know about what you did in school. All I just knew was you were a fun person, and every time my personality was showing up at the bus stop, you always engaged me. Then one day I get to know that you are in tech and doing techie stuff, and now you are doing very great techie stuff. Like, I was so confused. And clearly you didn't study, I mean, you did information studies, and information studies wasn't as very intensive as computer science or computer engineering or IT. And with psychology, for that matter. I'm just curious, like, what led you to first go and read psychology and information studies, and how did that have a huge impact in you, like, joining tech or becoming a techie in the long run?
So what actually led me into reading psychology and information studies? So if you're a Ghanaian and you went through the educational system, you'd realize that getting into the university wasn't really about what you wanted to read, especially for people, most people in the social sciences. It was just what the university gave you. I didn't have a choice. That's if your grades don't match up to what you want to read. So yeah, I think I fell within those categories, and I basically just went with what I was given. That's how come I read psychology and information studies. But I think along the lines, I fell in love with some of the courses in psychology, but then I really liked information studies because I would say that I wasn't tech inclined, but I had, you know, I liked it. I liked the way, you know, the things were going, how certain things were being done, and what I was being taught. I think those were the parts that I enjoyed about school.
So you read information studies, and you probably were introduced to a lot of, you know, concepts and tech and everything, programming and all that. Would you say you just went straight into UI, UX, or you did a bit of, you know, hardcore programming and code before it led you into what you are doing currently?
Okay, so for what I read in information studies, we were not introduced to programming. It wasn't an actual like technical, you know, program. What you find in information studies will be, you know, things about library books, you know, the library systems, and probably teaching you parts of a computer, which I felt at that stage was like way below us. But then, yeah, we're still taught those things. And I think one of the things that I still use is system design. That's mostly the main thing that I can connect to what I'm doing now. But aside that, how I went into programming, it wasn't even through that route. So right after school, we have something we call the National Service, where you're mandated to do a one-year service period in an institution you're posted to. It could be government or private. So I went into banking for that 1 year. And after banking, I didn't really feel a connection there. Let's just say I was just wild. I wanted to be out there and see what could happen for me. So I opted out, and I decided to explore. And then I came across a friend, an old roommate of mine, who introduced me to a Figma bootcamp. So that's the genesis of everything. So that's where my interest in design stemmed from. But even though I started from design, I didn't go into design. I rewinded, I rerouted to engineering software. So I did a bit of front end, and then finally came back to design. But we'll talk about that more as we go ahead.
Yeah. One will say that, you know, software engineering is like a hot career. Every company or every industry needs a software engineer. Mm-hmm. And we are always, you know, sitting in front of some software of a sort and always interacting with UI elements, right? That could have been a good, you know, chance for you to build your career and become a top-notch front-end developer. But then you chose to go on the other side of, you know, the design space, which is more UX, you know, UI. Why did you just happen to just maybe abandon, in quotes, the core engineering bit of design and went for a rather,
you know,
different, exactly, a more softer.
Right, yeah. I get it. But something about this story is deeply rooted in my heart. And if I am to explain how I ended back in design, it's going to be like a very long route, but I'll give you like a summary. So I started the Figma bootcamp, which was about 4 weeks. We had one session every week, which was very interesting. So I said to myself, okay, if I'm designing mobile apps and websites, you know, how would it feel to actually build them out and then bring them to life? Because if you're a designer, you're a beginner, one challenge you're going to face is most of your designs will not end up in production. Right? So especially if you're just doing like dummy projects and you're not on projects where they're actually dedicated engineers to build these things out. So I was like, okay, I want to learn programming. I want to learn engineering. so that I can learn how to build these things. I had an opportunity to mentor a group of girls the following year in a mobile app development, which I hadn't started learning, but then I had to mentor them. The plan was I was actually just to be like a chaperone and then help them with some of their questions. But then at the end of the day, the tutor didn't show up and then we're supposed to step up into that position. So now I had to go learn how to build Android apps and then teach these girls for a challenge called Technovation Challenge. So we went through that process, we taught them, and I got the opportunity to take part in another bootcamp by the Ghana Tech Lab. And that was a mobile app development program. So I went to that program, I learned how to build in JavaScript, React, React Native, and I think that was my journey into front end. How I ended back in design. So after Ghana Tech Lab, after the program, we went through this whole series of this startup journey, and actually co-founded a fintech startup with another lady called Elom.
In fact, you went ahead of us, but stay there because that was gonna be my next question. But you go for it.
Yeah,
I'm glad you went there.
Okay, I won't go into details so that you can ask that question.
Oh no, go for it. Go for it.
Okay, cool. So I co-founded this startup with Elom, and we were actually wanted to build a credit scoring model, right? And the whole idea was a credit scoring model, but then we sat back and realized, okay, we didn't have what we needed to build a credit scoring model. Where's the infrastructure? You know, we needed to identify certain stakeholders that we needed to work with so they can provide us with the data that we are looking for to score each individual on. And it was a very long, long road. At the end of the day, we had to pivot, you know, start from somewhere. So we decided to go into income and expense management, you know, and then use incoming data from people's accounts to be able to track whatever they're spending, their behavioral patterns, and then score them on it. And I think those phases required a lot more preparation than we thought we had. Because usually in these startup programs, they introduce you to it and then next thing you're flying. But then I think that the preparation phase, even emotionally, mentally, physically, you know, to make you understand that this is what you're going in for and it's going to be a long road, wasn't there. So in our minds, we felt really beaten emotionally because we had invested most parts of our lives. Almost 2 years into building this, we actually released a first version. We had more than 100 people test it, but we eventually had to close it down because we couldn't get that far. So with my broken heart, I decided to find something else to do. Initially, I said, you know, this tech thing, I'm over it. So I went into marketing, you know. I went into marketing for a year. But then during that year, I told myself, I really want to get back to design because the feeling that I had when I was starting off in Figma Bootcamp versus the feeling that I had when I was building my startup, there were two different things. And if anyone can attest, I mean, during the bootcamps, I was better at designing than development. So I was like, okay, why don't I grow this, you know? So I dedicated that year to building my portfolio. I worked on freelance design gigs while I was working as full-time as a marketing, you know, executive. So during the day, I'm in marketing. At night, I'm in design. So thankfully, exactly after a year, I had the opportunity to interview with an agency, and that's how I got my design role.
Interesting. So how would you say that your experience with, you know, having to close your startup down had a major impact on your view of tech and the ecosystem or tech in general?
That had It had a huge impact on me as a person, because it leaves you feeling a lot of things. You start to feel down, like a failure, and you literally have to re-strategize and like make up your mind that there are other things for me to do. You know, the fact that the startup failed doesn't mean that I have failed as a person. In the beginning, it was hard to separate those two. But then as I went on, I realized that if I want to do this, I have to detach myself from that phase and then be able to move on. And apparently after I was able to do that, you know, I meet people and then they go like, oh, we really admired what you were doing. And then this was me back then feeling like, oh, I can't do this. I'm a failure. And I wasn't doing this right. And then, you know, what would people think about me? I go out there, oh, she's the one that started the startup. And she couldn't pull through. But it was really the opposite. And people tend to admire females doing that. I think in Ghana, we didn't have, I'm not sure now, but at the time, Elam and I were sort of like the first founders that brought up, okay, income and expense tracking, you know, natively. But there were other apps in the system, you know, but they're not like Ghanaian founded. So I think that was just something that I held on to and decided to grow with it.
Honestly, you said people were inspired. I am one of those people. I was... Because anyone who knows me knows that my tech journey has been a very rigorous one. One will assume that I have a podcast right now, and meaning that I've always been a techie. But no, if you listen to the intro and the trailer, you will hear like bits and pieces that I struggled during my bachelor's. You know, I didn't even do well as much as I wanted to. It was in my master's that I would say I really had a very, you know, techie experience. And that was also very challenging. So seeing how you were very keen on it, you used to even reach out to me, message me. Because when I was in front, I remember all those. I was like, wow, you're really, really keen on getting this over the board. And it's always sad, you know, when you start something that has, you know, very good prospects, that unfortunately becomes... a historical event in your life that you can only talk about and nothing to show for. But that's fine, because I think after everything, you've been able to still, you know, pick yourself up and been able to build yourself into the space that you are in now. And I have seen you now, you are speaking at conferences, you are, you know, doing workshops and everything. So it has worked out in the long run. So I don't necessarily think it is bad. Okay, now let's delve a little bit into UX, right? The first time I had an idea of what UX could possibly be was in a class where they were talking about HCI, so human-computer interaction, where they were talking about the typical elements of how we interact with things, blah, 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 colors, all that kind of stuff. It didn't really intrigue me, I was like. But I saw a bit of, you know, the psychological part of things, you know, and how that will play a huge role in one's decision-making in terms of what a button should look like, how a button should feel, all that kind of stuff. Would you say your background in psychology had a huge impact in you becoming a UI, UX designer? If yes, how or what, can you give me one major scenario where you had to apply your psychology?
Okay, so did it have a huge impact? I wouldn't say that it actually influenced me into doing UX. But then once I was in UI UX, I could connect some things, you know, from psychology into that industry. These days, with what I do at WeWare, I find myself, you know, asking questions, especially when it comes to refining flows where users go through to achieve certain tasks.
Right.
So you find yourself asking certain questions. Where did they drop off? You know, why did they drop off? What is causing this? And you have different users coming to a product to achieve different things. But we realize that the product's also solving one problem. And you have to make room to be able to accommodate all of these types of users coming from different backgrounds. So people will fuss about color, you know, saying that this color could affect how this person thinks. Because, someone has some superstitious belief about red or blue or green or yellow. But that's like actual deep core UX. And looking at some of the things, you find that, okay, we are making decisions based on how users interact with this page. What are, you know, the touch points that they're clicking? Where do they spend more time? You know, what is causing them to delay at this point, right? Someone might be, you know, might perceive red differently, might perceive blue or green or gray differently. But looking at certain principles of psychology, you can attribute those things. You can make actual connections to principles in design, such that we'll say in gestalt psychology, you view things as a whole, right? So independent things coming together to be one thing. And then in design, we have different things on a page, but then they all should come into unison.
Right.
And then we have this thing about hierarchy, where you should see the biggest, the boldest, and then in descending order, right? You know, your main call to action, which could be a button, right?
So
call to actions are things that lead you to decision making points. Your main call to action should be actually very visible for the user to identify, so that they don't spend too much time going around finding, you know, what they want to achieve. So these are just like the few things that I can connect to psychology. But to say that it motivated me to go into UX, no.
Okay.
I just happened to read that and then happened to be in UX. So let's just say that's an advantage that I have.
A powerful one for that matter, I would say. Now, you did mention earlier when it comes, or you when you were talking about, you know, being a co-founder, you said there wasn't a lot of representation in the tech space, and for that matter, women, young as you are, trying to, you know, create such, you know, a robust app, like such a robust app, right? I believe for some time now the scene is changing. I think there are a lot more women that are speaking up about what they're doing in the tech space and everything, because PwC published, you know, a report where the percentage of women who are in tech,
yes,
and those that even stay in tech, the churn is, you know, very, very high. You get it. How would you say your journey as a woman in tech has been? Do you feel that the people you've had around you or the men you've had around you have been very helpful? If you want to give a particular person a shout out for really, you know, being a great mentor, holding your hand to get to where you are, or if it could be a man or a woman, but anyone who helped, you know, create space for you to flourish, make your necessary mistakes where you had to, correct you where they had to, and help you build the career that you have now.
Right. So throughout my journey, I wouldn't say that I've experienced, you know, that kind of bias, but, well, I think that it could also be from the period that, you know, I started learning how to design and then started learning software engineering. It could also be from that period, because I've heard stories about, you know, people being looked down on, women not being given equal opportunity. But for the programs that I was in, women were actually encouraged. I think those were the few programs that were encouraging girls and women to take up such roles. I think the only time that I would say that this happened was, maybe this was just in our minds, but in a short story going back to our startup days. So we needed APIs, right, to be able to get some of the data that we needed for the credit scoring model. And we went to this giant telecommunications company, I don't want to mention the name, but if you know Giants, you should know. We needed some APIs. We had done our research. We knew what we wanted. We knew competitors that were already using their APIs, right? Which at the time they may have been customized for those competitors, right? When I say competitors, I mean our competitors, not their competitors. So that we're actually partnering with these people to provide certain services for their customers. And we went through the process, we met some of their reps, and all they could tell us was, no, this is not available for you to use. And we went as far as the Bank of Ghana, right? The Central Bank. And we wanted to get into GIPS to be able to find out what was happening. That was as at 2020. So as at 2019, GIPS was fairly new. And GIPS is an interbank payment platform, sort of, that was set up by the Central Bank. So it just aids interoperability between networks and banks and everything. So we wanted that API, so we went to GIPS. We didn't get good feedback. And at the end of the day, Elon and I just said to ourselves that, you know, it's probably because we are two young girls. Two young girls. And they don't think that, oh, we are serious about what we are saying. But then we have prototypes to show them. We can show them this, we can show them that. At the end of the day, if a partner comes in, if we had funding, right? If we had...
like VC on board.
Yeah, if we had some sort of backing, it would have been different. Right.
And not necessarily backing whether it be male dominated or female, but once there was a more structured institution around what you guys were doing, it could have.
Definitely. And we even had to rope in the Ghana Tech Lab on this, where we actually started from. So can you people help us get into this place? They could only provide us with a letter. And it was really sad. But I think that was the only part that we experienced, you know. But I would say that looking back now, I think I met someone recently, an old friend, who actually works with that institution now. And he mentioned that they were actually developing those APIs. Even though there were transaction APIs that we could work with, they hadn't, you know, structured it in a way which they could serve to, you know, other startups and things. And for that partner they were working with, it was on a strict basis. And they were also like an established company. So there were ways to go around, you know, how to serve customers and things like that. And they were not using their APIs for, you know, third-party purposes. It was going back into the customers for that same company. People that held our hands during those times. So I remember we had, in those spaces, right, I think that when you get into those spaces, it's really good because it introduces you to a network of mentors, right? So depending on what you're working on, depending on what you're building, you identify which mentor would sort of help you to grow in that light. And through interactions, you know, through networking, you get to identify some of these people, especially with, you know, the passion that they have or their business lines, right? So we met Mr. Amo. I would mention his name, of InnoHub. He's actually the founder of InnoHub. And he held a hand through those stages. He introduced us again to Solomon Chum. He's also a director at Reach for Change. He took us through some building blocks in our startups. They ran us through, you know, how to run a business. Different things that we really didn't know. I thought I knew certain things about finance because I worked in a bank, but no, they were totally different, you know. Even how to set up a business plan, the lean startup model, all of those things. They really helped us. And I think that coming into design, I had one mentor who also helped me a lot. I had two, right? So for my Figma bootcamp, I had James Badour, who's currently the co-founder of ADP List, and also Joseph Kipo. He currently works with M Pharma as a designer as well. So those people, I really, really can't take them out of my journey. They've helped me a lot. And at every stage in time, I always remember them. You know, sometimes I reach back, you know, just to get some details on how I can improve myself. You know, how am I doing in this field? How where do I go from here? You know, just certain pointers, because most of the time, when someone has gone ahead of you in a phase or like in a business line, you they make certain mistakes where you can learn from, so that you don't get to repeat those things in your journey.
That's good. That's good. I had an episode with a friend of mine, Kwame, and he made me realize that naturally I'm one who just likes to, you know, do a lot of mentoring, like to, you know, pour into people and all that I've learned.
Yes,
and
was,
yeah, quite obvious. And I am a product of, you know, people holding my hands to get to where I was. I remember the first mobile app project I worked on, boy, it was terrible. It was an Android app. And for those of you, and for those who know Android development, there is something called an activity and there's something called a fragment, right? And there are times where an activity is more sensible to use in that particular, you know, user journey. If I could use a bit of UX, UI, is that a right term? Is that a right term to use?
For what you're explaining, because I don't know.
But I'm talking about like the flow of the user using the app.
Yeah.
What's the right term I will use there?
A user journey on
app. Okay, good. All right. So I was there. You know, not too bad. Maybe I should explore a career in UX after all. But yeah, and a time where a fragment will make more sense, because an activity may be relatively heavy and that could distort the entire flow. It's a lot of things. And at times where my sister saw me really burn the midnight candle, trying to work on that app, and it didn't. Unfortunately, the app did not come to fruition.
No.
It was a very sad situation. We're trying to build an Uber-like service for a particular client who had a particular niche of people in a different country, and the idea was good, and it was, you know, that was where I got to learn a lot of things. You know, Firebase. I mean, the guys. Every time I'm on the podcast, Thomas, Saeed, and Fitzgerald, those guys were very helpful. They allowed me to make very foolish mistakes. They allowed me to write unnecessary for loops. They used to tell me that I seem to like spaghetti because my code is always spaghetti code.
Yes.
Exactly. And like, they really helped, you know, me understand, you know, how to think properly on a lot of things. And I'm still growing in that area. So when I see people also taking up mentorship at the same time, me, like, for myself as an example, I'm very happy, you know, because there's someone out there who wants to be inspired by your journey. I've had people who shot their shot at me on LinkedIn. I currently mentor four young men, because they are not boys any longer, actively. And one is not even a techie. One is from economics background, but there's enough, you know, in me to, you know, help him, you know, make better decisions and everything. So yeah, I do agree that it's very essential for us to help people and help them also make their own mistakes, but then guide them in making those mistakes. I'm very strong not to also be too corrective of the mistakes I made in my life, that I don't allow people to also grow by making their mistakes. But then I'll let them minimize. You know, you make one fall, you know, okay, the next fall you're going to do is going to break your leg.
Yeah.
So let's maybe put some cushion there. Let's rather re-strategize. You get it? Now let's get away. Let's get away from typical heavy tech conversations and all that. What does your everyday look like? You know, I'm sure people will see you, you know, people will see you as a boss lady on Instagram or the LinkedIn, and it's like they see you doing the stuff they admire and all. And it looks good. It looks fancy. Social media is beautiful. But then there are other parts that people will not really see. Mm-hmm. What does your everyday look like? And how do you, you know, try to take, you know, a breather, relax and wind down?
Right. So like you're saying, people will see you on social media being, oh, that's a UX designer. She works at WeWork Africa and all of that. But in my mind, inside me, everything is going helter-skelter. I've tried to figure out what's the next thing I need to do. I have to check off these tasks on ClickUp. I have to, you know, let these things go on Jira. I have to update the components. I have to do this. But making sense out of it all, right? Sometimes I just need to slow down and then think, you know. It's one thing I learned from a friend was that you always make a plan. So one thing I do these days, I make a plan. I write down the things I need to do, which includes work and out of work. So even for things I do at home, things I do outside the house, things I do at work, I make a plan for everything. And I get to go throughout the day checking off these tasks, right? But then in the work environment, what I do as a UX designer, first of all, I would like to say that it's really fun working at WeWork. I like the culture. And yeah, because I came from an agency. And if you've been in an agency before as a designer or like a developer, you know how fast-paced it is, which makes me appreciate, you know, that environment. But then you also get to see how relaxed product companies are. And so for a day-to-day activity for UX designer, once you get to work, so I do a hybrid system, both in office and in remote. So once the day starts, we usually have this thing we do where you list out everything you need to do for the day, what you did yesterday, what you're doing today. Or if it's weekly, what you did the previous week, what you're doing this week, right? So that there's some sort of accountability for everyone. What we do is, because we're a small team, we check up on each other. We make sure that, okay, my tasks are not blockers for you. And I get to check off things in time so that you can also get to move at your own pace, right? So basically that's how my day looks like. So if I'm not designing, I'm looking into how to improve our components. I'm working on mobile responsiveness and all that sort. And also we have people that want to enter into the design space right in the office. So in our team, there's one person that wants to, you know, go on that design tangent. So we do a bit of mentoring there. We'll have UX design live sessions with other people as well. We have two people actually joining in who are outside WeWork. So they join in, we have design sessions. Sometimes we just have reviews. Sometimes we talk about tasks and how to go about certain things. Other days too, we just do clones of, you know, very good websites, and then go through how they actually represent a certain things, design processes, and then things like that. Yeah, basically, so that's how my day is like. Aside those things, I freelance as well. So extra time, you definitely find me trying to get some extra cash.
That's good. You did mention that you are interested in, you know, kids with special needs and everything. And I found that very intriguing. I wanted to just talk a little bit about that. What led you into that, and what do you do in that organization?
Okay, so that's way outside design and then tech. But the name is the Beautiful Life Foundation. Okay. So how it started is actually my sister's foundation. And she has a kid with cerebral palsy, right? So, you know, that whole thing about She's fortunate enough to have been in school for a period, and it had to be a special school. But then meeting all of these children and looking at how their lives are totally affected by the conditions, she thought it wise to offer some kind of support to not the actual, you know, people with disabilities, but then the families mm-hmm. as well. Right. So most of the time we have organizations coming in, okay, I want to help with this person's fees. Okay, I want to get a wheelchair for this disabled child. But then what the family actually goes through to be able to support this person, you have no idea. Because if you have such a child or such a person in your family, there's always supposed to be one person dedicated to taking care of them, right? So if you do not have the funds to hire a nurse or a day nanny or something like that, you know, you have to basically restructure your life to be able to fit them into your right. schedule. So our foundation is focused on offering solutions or help in any way possible to families of people with special needs. Now, special needs can range from cerebral palsy, autism, Down syndrome, any kind of developmental, you know, conditions in children, not only children, but in adults as well. We have respite programs. We train people in entrepreneurial skills. Most of these providers or caretakers have to abandon their careers, have to abandon their jobs to be able to stay home to take care of these people. And then feeding at the end of the day becomes very difficult. In a part of the world, people are not really educated on these conditions, right? We have a lot of religious beliefs, superstitions concerning people with special needs and, you know, people with disabilities. So you find that a lot of these people taking care of the kids are usually the mothers. And these mothers are basically abandoned by everybody. For a few of them, you find supportive families, you know, coming in to help where necessary. But most of them, you realize that they have no one at all. So we also have certain partners that are on board that offer monthly stipends mm-hmm. to these families just to help them get by. And our plan is also to train them in certain skills that they can actually make a living out of, even from their homes. Right. So that's what we've been doing since 2020. We actually founded in 2019, but then that's what we've been doing since 2020. And yeah.
That's amazing. So far, so good. Now, just, you know, my last but one question. Would you ever go back into entrepreneurship or founding a startup or something of a sort?
Definitely, definitely. But one thing I will not do is go back into fintech. No way. No way. Because
you never say never. You never know. Maybe this time you get to.
No, you know what? Regulatory bodies, right, drained the life out of me. They took away everything. It's not as if, you know, they closed us down or something, but you realize that the barriers to entry for every fintech is really high. It's really, really high. And if you don't have proper structures, and you're just starting off like the way Element I did, you're sure to go down very soon. Because without structures in place, the right funding, good mentorship, you know, a good plan, a roadmap, I don't think you'd be able to survive. But I think that how regulations and regulatory bodies have evolved is actually good, because these days the central banks have something they call the fintech sandbox, where fintechs can tap into to access APIs. During our time there was nothing like that. It was actually a year or two after we quit that was when we had that fintech sandbox come into place. But yeah, one thing I will never do is go back into fintech. I have other ideas in tech as well, but then it will take a little bit of courage to go back into that.
That's good. That's good. Lastly, you know, someone, like I said, a lot of people look at social media and just see the glitz part of it. And today we've spoken about so many things, the details of your life and all that. What advice would you give to someone, specifically for a lady, based on the title of the episode? What advice would you give to a lady who is either starting or currently in the space and is having some very interesting seasons, or is thinking about even leaving in the long run? Maybe try and give an advice for each of these categories.
So first thing, I saw a post on social media recently saying that tech is overrated, but I don't think so. Anyway, regardless, I think that tech can be very overwhelming, you know. I think that our learning styles and our teaching styles have not allowed us to go so deep when it comes to learning on your own and try to discover things you can do by yourself, right? We mostly rely on what we are taught, feeding and things like that. So when you get into an environment where you have to do a lot of digging by yourself, you have to learn continuously, it can be very overwhelming. And there are so many trends coming up. There are so many roles. First of all, if you even want to transition like I did, how do you identify, okay, what do I want to do? You know, where do my interests lie? What can be, what are the low-hanging fruits that I can achieve and then move to the next? So as overwhelming as it can be, you just need to take your time, right? If you're venturing into tech, first of all, identify where your interests lie. Once you do this, you can also find people in those spaces that you can reach out for mentorship. And reaching out doesn't really have to mean that you know the person. Some people actually dedicate their extra time to mentor people. So once you reach out to them, you're sure that this person will be able to help you out, right? And then you would have to learn continuously. Because even as I sit here now, I feel like I'm so far behind. Because there are so many new things in design that I need to learn that I feel like, oh, I need to catch up with these things, right? So even though you may be in it, but then you have to learn continuously. And then while you do that, you have to let people see that, okay, you are hungry for this knowledge, you know. Go to extra lengths to achieve what you want to achieve, right? And I think the last thing will be you have to be committed and be consistent. Okay. You can learn a ton of things today, and then tomorrow there'll be a new ton of things released, right? Not to say that you're chasing after new trends, but then keeping yourself abreast and then always making sure that you stay afloat. You need to be committed in terms of time. If you are having to learn a new skill, it doesn't matter how many things you do in a day, but how often you keep at it, right, will bring out, you know, that understanding or that level that you want to reach. So those four things, being committed, learning continuously, finding mentorship, right, and then identifying your interest. I think that's what I'll say to those looking to enter into tech.
Well, Ibiya, you do hear me say this a lot of the time, but I'm going to say it again. I am super proud of you. And I'm sure you know why. And no one needs to know, because it's our own details. But I have seen you, you know, jump a lot of hurdles and you just keep moving forward. And you have this very positive mindset. You acknowledge, you know, the challenges that a lot of these events have, you know, had or played a role in your life, but you are very much my mantra, you know, stay resilient and go for gold. When I chose that mantra, I didn't know that when you choose a mantra like that, God will choose to give you things that will cause you to stay resilient and go for good. But yes, and I'm excited about the next phase of your career. I think, you know, you have a budding career ahead of you. You're already doing the great stuff. You're speaking at engagements. I see you on the panel with like huge people in the industry. And, you know, show me your friend and I'll show you who you are. You know, so you are sum total of the people you surround yourself with. So kudos to how far you've come, and, you know, don't stay there. You know, there's so much ahead of us. There's so much potential in us that we can explore. So just keep pushing. And you know me, I'm your cheerleader for life. I'll be cheering you on,
always.
Cheering you always. On and seeing you rise to the top. So thanks so much for making time.
Thank you too. It was amazing being here.
My pleasure.
Indeed, adventures can be exciting but also heartbreaking. From Ibia's journey as a woman in tech, having occupied roles in marketing, UI/UX design, and co-founding her startup Spendly, she reminds us that regardless of your gender, there is enough opportunity for you to excel if you can only be just a little bit resilient and push yourself towards your goals. Thank you for listening to today's episode of the TechSurf Podcast. See you in the next episode.